A University of Montana worker is injured in a fall through a skylight onto a boiler. Good evening. I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about a proposed ballot measure that seeks to limit the influence of dark money in elections. Flathead reporter Catherine Fry previews an important training opportunity for people who want to recreate in the backcountry this winter. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talked with Fire Information Officer Cindy Super about this year's fire season and how to prepare for next year. A University of Montana employee working on the roof of the campus heating plant was injured when he fell between 15 and 20 feet through a skylight and landed on a boiler. University spokeswoman Peggy Kerr says 61-year-old Mike Burke was hospitalized in stable condition after the fall, which happened at about 9:15 this morning while Burke was checking a flue gas chamber on the roof of the campus heating plant.
When he fell through a skylight about 20 feet on top of one of the boilers. So he did not fall in a boiler, but he fell onto the top of one of the big boilers in the heating plant.
Kerr says no one saw Burke fall. It took emergency crews about an hour to remove him from the heating plant and get him into an ambulance.
Interestingly, the fire department has practiced getting someone off those boilers as part of their standard training. So they've done practice sessions of this kind of extraction, as it's called. And the first thing, of course, was just assuring his safety, figuring out how he was doing. They did put him on a backboard just to assure there's no additional harm done by moving the person. And then they brought him down, stabilized.
Burke is a longtime UM employee and the heating plant's chief engineer. Kerr says he's out of surgery this afternoon and in stable condition. She says the physical plant has a good safety record and the university will investigate this incident to learn how to keep it from happening again. And in other news from around the state, about two dozen protesters rallied outside Congressman Steve Daines' Helena Field office today, calling for an end to the partial federal government shutdown, now in its second week. The group brought together by the Montana Organizing Project represented a wide range of ages. Organizer Elizabeth Marum says she knows cuts to entitlements are not on the table now as part of the discussions to end the federal government shutdown. But she says those types of proposals are a part of wider budget negotiations, and she says the protesters want to send a message that that is not acceptable.
These are earned benefits. We have paid into these accounts sometimes over years of our working life, and these programs should not be diminished or decreased. They should be expanded.
A spokesperson from Congressman Daines' office says the congressman knows the importance of programs like Social Security and Medicare and is committed to protecting them for current and future generations of seniors. As for the shutdown, Daines' office says it's time for President Obama and Senate Democrats to work with the House to find a solution. A prominent Republican state senator is leading efforts to qualify an initiative for the 2014 ballot, which would require more disclosure of political spending on state elections. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us the initiative is based upon a dark money bill that failed this last legislative session.
Buffalo, Montana Republican Senator Jim Peterson teamed up with Democratic Governor Steve Bullock this last legislature to push for the TRACE Act. The bill tried to force improved disclosure from third-party groups so voters better understand who is behind political speech. It passed a Republican-controlled Senate, but was tabled in a committee when it went over to the House, so the measure died. Here's Peterson.
One of the criticisms of the bill was it was too big, too comprehensive, and some people thought too confusing.
The TRACE Act was a big bill. It changed contribution limits and reporting calendars. It was a campaign finance overhaul in a lot of ways. So now Peterson and other supporters are trying to put a simpler version before voters, a version of the bill which just contains parts of the TRACE Act related to disclosure. Peterson says the Stop Dark Money initiative strengthens reporting and disclosure for everyone who chooses to be involved in the political process. He says anonymous political spending from out-of-state corporations and special interests is becoming a bigger and bigger player in Montana politics.
Montana voters want to maintain control of their state politically, they want the decisions to be made locally, then there needs to be full disclosure of who's sending the message and who's paying for the message.
The initiative requires disclosure on any spending of $500 or more on specific election-related advocacy. This includes advertisements or mailings aired or sent within 60 days of an election that refers to a candidate, party, or issue before voters. If the advertisement or mailer directly advocates the election or defeat of one of those things, disclosure is required all year. Peterson says candidates already have to disclose who spends more than $35 on their campaign. He says the initiative would level the playing field for special interests or anyone else taking part in election advocacy efforts.
Pretty much applies to everybody. Nonprofits, for-profits, unions, everybody.
During the legislature, the TRACE Act was generally opposed by conservative Republicans who argue anonymous political speech has been an important and protected right in the United States since its founding. Red Lodge Republican Senator Jason Priest has been tied to anonymous election mailers, which have been sent out attacking moderate Republicans like Peterson. Priest opposed the TRACE Act and believes this initiative has the same constitutional flaws.
You know, he's willing to throw free speech and the taxpayers of Montana who are going to have to defend this foolish lawsuit that's going to eventually come. He's throwing those people under the bus so he can protect the voting records of him and his buddies who aren't voting in the interest of their districts.
But initiative organizer Sandy Welch believes the U.S. Supreme Court feels otherwise on the constitutionality of measures like this. She says the court right now is trending toward eliminating campaign spending limits, but increasing and upholding disclosure requirements.
They're saying that having campaign contribution limits is an infringement on free speech, but that disclosure requirements are important in order to let voters know who's delivering a message and to fight corruption.
Initiative organizers say they expect bipartisan support in this effort and count Billings Democratic Senator Robin Driscoll as one of the first donors. The measure is in its signature gathering phase right now. Supporters need to gather signatures from at least 5% of Montana voters in at least 34 of the state's House districts. Those need to be collected by next June for the initiative to make the November 2014 ballot. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
The second case of brucellosis found in a week in cattle in southwest Montana has prompted Texas officials to require an additional test of any cattle they import from that region of Montana. The first case of the livestock disease was found in a cow in Madison County on September 26th. The second case was found in a bull in Park County just over a week later. The new Texas testing rule requires the imported animals be quarantined until the second test can be done, and that quarantine could last up to a year, according to Montana State veterinarian Marty Zalewski. He thinks the Texas requirement is an unnecessary burden.
If you look at our record, we've had about 30 animals that have tested for brucellosis in the last 6 or 7 years. I mean, if all of those cattle that we found with brucellosis have been within our surveillance area, we found them on the ranch before they've reached the market, gone in interstate commerce. I mean, when you look at the relative risk for the number of cattle that we have in the state, the number of cattle that we ship interstate, and then the extremely low number of positives, I can't see or reconcile that this Texas rule is actually warranted.
The disease, brucellosis, is carried by both elk and bison in the Yellowstone region. Zalewski suspects the cattle were infected by elk, but he says they're conducting a thorough investigation.
We're going to look at where cattle came from into these herds. We're going to look at adjacent herds, see if there's been potentially some additional transmission. In previous cases, however, all that work really did not show an additional risk aside from a brucellosis-infected elk. And in this situation, because these cases are in our surveillance area where we know that brucellosis elk exist, we feel that at this point that's the most likely source is some kind of abortion event or some kind of calving event from an infected elk infected these cattle.
Zalewski emphasizes the rate of infection is extremely low, and he says Montana's testing program successfully prevents the disease from spreading within herds. Snow starting to cap western Montana's mountains serves as a reminder that ski season isn't too far off. Another reminder, avalanche classes. Reporter Katrin Fry has more on how an avalanche workshop represents not only the growing interest in wintertime backcountry travel, but the need for avalanche education in the Flathead.
The Northern Rockies Avalanche Safety Workshop started up 3 years ago, and chairman of the workshop committee, Craig Moore, says it keeps growing in popularity. He says the first year they hoped to get maybe 50 people and ended up with more than 200.
So that first year we really created, you know, a big buzz. I mean, it kind of became, you know, the community coming together to go, you know, back into the winter, changing a season. So we're trying to do it, you know, before hunting season. And then we're also trying to compete now that we've made this monster. We're kind of on the map with the avalanche community.
Moore says some of the speakers they're bringing in are sought after for well-known workshops across the country and the world. The Northern Rockies Avalanche Safety Workshop is one day, this Saturday the 12th in Whitefish, and runs from 8 to 4, featuring a range of speakers and backcountry winter safety gear representatives. Moore says similar workshops are usually held in larger markets.
And I think that's what has made our market interesting, is that this has become successful, you know, in our small town of, you know, 6,000 in Whitefish, but our community of 100,000, it just shows the need for this, I think, you know, not just here, but I think in other communities across the West.
The Colorado Avalanche Information Center counts 24 people dead in the U.S. due to avalanches in the 2012-2013 winter season alone. Those killed were climbing, riding snowmobiles, skiing, and snowshoeing. The Northwest Weather and Avalanche Center reports 86 people killed in avalanches in Montana since 1985. Between 1985 and 1999, Montana lost 28 people in avalanches. Since the 1999-2000 winter season, 58 people have been killed in Montana in avalanches, doubling the number of people killed in the same amount of time. The government shutdown has affected the workshop. Leanne Allegretto with the National Weather Service out of Missoula is not coming, but Moore says she created a video to stand in for her presentation. Other speakers include avalanche forecaster Eric Knopf with the Gallatin National Forest Avalanche Center and Seth Carbonari with the Flathead Avalanche Center, as well as Brian Lazar with the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, Bruce Tremper with the Forest Service Utah Avalanche Center, and internationally certified guide and trainer Colin Zacharias with the Canadian Avalanche Association.
I mean, that's ultimately our goal, is we want to inform our community of cutting-edge technology with snow science and just kind of a general refresher of information, from decision-making to snow science to, you know, gear.
Moore says the workshop is open to all winter backcountry enthusiasts, professionals as well as users, skiers, snowmobile riders, snowboarders, hikers, climbers, anyone accessing the backcountry. He says technology is making the backcountry more accessible, whether through improved touring bindings or bigger horsepower in snowmobile motors. He says having the proper safety gear, avalanche transceivers or beacons, shovels and probes, is only the first step.
We need to educate ourselves with, you know, how to travel safely, what to do in case of an emergency, have basic first aid and response, and know that when you're in the backcountry, the only one who's going to rescue you is someone in your party.
Moore also volunteers with the Flathead Nordic Ski Patrol, which the Sheriff's Department calls for wintertime search and rescue.
I think that's what drives me to do this, is having, you know, lost members of our community, and, you know, just anyone, you know, from Whitefish to Bozeman to wherever. I feel like, you know, all of us in the ski community or in backcountry community are kind of bound together by that, you know, powerful Mother Nature factor that, you know, no one's bigger than the mountains.
It costs $20 ahead of time or $25 at the door to attend Saturday's workshop. Moore says any proceeds are donated. Past beneficiaries include the Flathead Nordic Backcountry Patrol, the Ski Patrol at Big Mountain, and funds have helped support a beacon park at the Whitefish Mountain Resort, as well as the beacon check stations at popular backcountry access sites put up by the Nordic Patrol. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
Western Montana's fire danger is back to a low rating. There's been plenty of rain recently, even some high-elevation snow in western Montana. All the signs point to the end of 2013's fire season. In tonight's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, DNRC's Southwest Land Office Fire Prevention Coordinator Cindy Super recaps this year's fire season, which was quite active in west-central Montana, where well over 11,000 acres burned.
The bulk of our fires this year, at least from the DNRC's perspective, were right here in Missoula County, kind of as far away as Phillipsburg, which kicked things off in May, and then absolutely stuff going on in and around the Missoula area, Arlee, Frenchtown, Lolo, and Clinton. So it seemed very concentrated in this area.
Why is that? Was it a little drier around here, or just luck of the lightning draw? What?
Luck of the lightning draw is probably a good way to put it. We had predictive services had been really concerned about more the southern part of Montana, the Dillon area, and Butte, because of the dryness of the fuels in those areas. Missoula wasn't really on the radar for receiving anything extraordinary, but they always have the caveat in there that a lot of it just depends on where the lightning falls. And, of course, we always have human-caused fires that we're concerned about, but it seemed like in this area, especially with some of the more recent big fires, in particular the Lolo complex, it was lightning. The number of fires we had was pretty consistent, maybe a few more as compared to last year and 2011. So with the Missoula unit, we had the Mill Creek, that was 700 acres. Nimrod was over 600. The Schoolhouse, which, of course, became part of the Lolo Creek complex, the Miller Creek fire, and then we assisted with the Duncan Drive, the one that was lightning struck a power pole. That was the city's fire, but we assisted. And so within the rest of our protection, Rumsey Gulch out in Phillipsburg was the only other fire that the Southwestern Land Office had that was over 100 acres.
The season started off tragically in Arizona with the death of 19 firefighters at the Yarnell Hill incident. That had to be on the tops of every ground pounder and fire manager in the country. Do you think an event like that affects firefighting, makes crews and bosses a little more, conservative in their approach to fighting fire?
I don't know about conservative, but I think it definitely makes us more thoughtful. And I really hope that there becomes a good dialogue over this winter and the next couple of years. I'm very curious to see what will happen here in the future with regard to firefighting. I think, you know, just kind of my personal opinion, it's worth looking into where we're putting people and for what purposes. It's extremely expensive. Firefighting can be extremely effective. Heavy air tankers and hotshot crews and these highly skilled, highly trained, really experienced people, but there's no silver bullet. Having more air tankers is not a silver bullet answer for something like that. And so I hope that there is a national dialogue and that we do start looking at how we're doing things and how we can work together with homeowners and with folks who live in the urban interface to make firefighting safer.
Boy, that's, as you say, a very difficult dialogue. Is that dialogue being had already in the halls of various state federal agencies, do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of things that have been written, and hopefully you've taken some time to read the Yarnell incident report. In fact, I was just reading an article in Wildfire Magazine, which is published by the International Association of Wildland Fire, talking about this sort of thing and just wanting to start asking those questions and looking at, okay, what next? This is not the first big tragedy, obviously. There was Man Gulch. People have been losing their lives in wildland fires for a long time. And so the national dialogue, I think, will be very interesting. And, you know, I know that it is something that both within our agency, the DNRC here, and then the various incident management teams that came through Missoula County, it was touched on almost daily, like the discussion of, hey, we're not here to sacrifice people's lives for homes.
You know, Ms. Super, we of course hear about the big fires, but we hardly ever hear about all those little incidents that initial attack crews snuff out. And there were a lot of those this year, weren't there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, with the Southwestern Land Office, we responded to almost 200 fire reports. 97% of those were caught at 10 acres or less. And really, I would say the bulk of those were caught at 1 acre or less. Most of them rarely get above a tenth or a quarter acre. And so there's a lot of activity that firefighters are doing every year that people don't really ever hear about. It's interesting to be a part of, and it's interesting to watch, and you know, a big part of my job is working with the public to prevent unnecessary human-caused fires. And so, you know, when you're looking at going camping or you want to have a burn pile where you're trying to do some fuels reduction work around your house, just take a few extra minutes when you think that fire is out and really stir into it, put water on it, put your hands into it, and make sure that it's actually out.
Late in the season, things were rocking and rolling, and then we'd read these stories you and your colleagues would tell us in the media about people who would go camping, they would light their campfires, and they would just forget about them, basically. Barely put them out, in some cases, not even put them out, and walk away. That's got to be frustrating for you all.
It can be very frustrating, but I can also understand when most people are looking at a campfire, you know, and maybe they get up early and they have their fire and they're looking at it and it's calm, it's quiet, it's relatively cool in the morning. And then, of course, we've got higher relative humidities. The fire may not look like it's doing much. You know, there might be some hot coals left, and I think a lot of times people maybe, I hope that they're not just being negligent. I would always try and give people the benefit of the doubt that they just think, well, it's going to go out. And a lot of times it does, but not always. And you can always have a puff of wind come up and blow hot embers into dry grass. And conditions are vastly different at 2 or 3 in the afternoon than they are at 8 o'clock in the morning. Some of it is just sort of that educational process and helping people to understand. And firefighters have to learn that as well. I mean, I remember being a firefighter and sitting around a fire that was maybe an acre in size. There were four of us there and thinking, well, this is a big waste of time. This fire's out. And then glancing across the fire 20 feet away from me, and there's a little puff of smoke that we had missed. And so it's, I mean, that's a good lesson. And all young firefighters go through that. And all of us learn at some level to make sure that something's out. You really do have to get down into the dirt and put your hands in the fire and make sure that it is dead out.
Yeah. Last question, Cindy, and that is, we are now in fall. Winter's fast approaching. The snow will be flying soon, and we're all going to forget about wildfires for a while, but they, of course, will be back. What can, what should people in that rural-urban interface be thinking about now that they have a little bit of elbow room?
Absolutely great question, you know, and of course, I would hope that people don't forget about fires, but I understand there's a lot of demands on people's time and their energy. And so what we've been telling people on the various urban interface fires that I've had the pleasure of doing fire information for all summer is that the fire that you can see is not necessarily the one that you have to worry about. This is Western Montana. There will always be wildland fire. It's unreasonable to expect that we can always have somebody there to immediately protect you and your home. And so people need to have a plan. It's very basic. I understand that it's difficult to do. There are resources to help people everywhere from, you know, a single home with, you know, one or two trees or barely any acreage should be paying attention to what they would do in case they're evacuated. And if people have 10 acres or 50 acres or 100 acres, there's programs in place to help with fuels reduction and even just people who can come out and advise you on some options and alternatives that you can, how you can make your forest more healthy, not just for wildland fire, but things like mountain pine beetle or wind damage, all sorts of different things that can damage your timberlands. So people should visit firesafemt.org is a good place to start. Also, we have a program that we're starting to promote, which is the Ready, Set, Go, and that is handled through the local fire departments. And people can always call their local DNRC office or fire department or the Forest Service for help.
Cindy Super of the Montana DNRC, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for your excellent information when things are rocking and rolling in the summertime. And on behalf, I think, of so many people, thank you to the men and women who put it all on the line during the height of fire season to keep us and our property and our animals safe. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ed. Have a great day.
Now for tonight's forecast. Across our listening area tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain and snow, with lows in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow and highs in the mid-40s to 50s. And now for the editorial comments of Dan Gallagher.
This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint. First of all, let me remind you that Veterans Day is coming up, Monday, November 11th. And once again this year, American Legion Post 101 will sponsor the Missoula Veterans Day ceremony on the county courthouse lawn. And again, I'll be organizing the event. As in years past, there will be the opportunity for those in attendance to place flowers on an honor table in remembrance of a veteran or veterans of special importance in their lives, or simply to recognize the service and sacrifice of all veterans. Post 101 provides the flowers. The speaking schedule at this ceremony has not yet been finalized. Each year, a theme is established specific to that year's ceremony. This year, 2013, the theme of the Missoula Veterans Day ceremony will be For Those with Wounds That Show No Scars, focusing on the untold number of veterans who return from war psychologically or emotionally damaged. Now, I've talked about this issue many times in commentaries, but it remains one of the most unresolved of veterans' problems. This Veterans Day, that seemingly intractable issue will be talked about in order that its importance and urgency are emphasized to all who are willing to hear the American veteran's story, touching as well on ways that might help alleviate the problem. You know, as an aging Vietnam veteran and a longtime veterans advocate, I must admit to frequent bouts of cynicism and despair when it comes to seeking resolution and genuine respect and concern for veterans. And recently, that cynicism has been in full bloom. And on those occasions when the cynic in me takes over, there are even times I doubt the very sanity of holding on to a belief that common sense and compassion will prevail in the world of veterans' care and recognition, or any other part of the world for that matter. And there are plenty of opportunities to be disheartened. To wit, I look at the history of the Vietnam Veterans Collective return from war and see their doubly high unemployment rate, incarceration rate, substance abuse rate, and their rate of family breakups. And then I recall that more Vietnam veterans committed suicide than the number of American GIs who were killed by the enemy in that war. And I wonder why those statistics didn't shock our political leaders and our citizens into doing at least enough to minimize the problems. After all, when our country sets a worthy goal for itself, nothing will stop us. Remember how we pursued the space race until, finally, Armstrong took that one giant leap for mankind? If we have the ability and the motivation to put a man on the moon, we can sure as hell find a way to help a generation of veterans find enough readjustment peace for them to get through their crises. Yet little seems to have changed in the years since Vietnam. We now find that our newest generation of veterans, those of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, are committing suicide and being subject to those other problems at a rate that is statistically equal to or even greater than that of their Vietnam-era predecessors. Do the folks in government who are charged with finding remedies for veterans' issues truly appreciate the depth and irony and tragedy of those recurring acts of self-destruction by young veterans? And what about the American citizen? Is he or she alarmed about this to the point of speaking up? Or do they still seem convinced that a plastic magnetic yellow ribbon on their SUV is all that's required? I fear the answer to all of these questions is not one that's in the best interest of veterans. And in some ways, it actually seems to be getting worse. We're now witnessing a government in shutdown and a nation on the edge of default because a coterie of ideologues in Washington, D.C. are willing to hold the people's interests hostage to their zealot-like beliefs and prejudices. And how does this affect veterans? Well, depending on the length of the shutdown, veterans' care and compensation may well become a casualty. But worse than that, there are actual examples of the harm and insult it's causing now in an increasing number of personalized situations. For example, I was told today that the resources provided to the families of our soldiers who are killed in Iraq or Afghanistan, so that the families can be on hand at Dover to accept their beloved soldiers' remains, have been curtailed due to the government shutdown. The parents, spouses, and children of the five GIs who were killed in Afghanistan just this week will not be able to watch the flag-draped coffins of those honored dead touch American soil just before their bodies are committed to that hallowed ground back home. I guess those dead soldiers and their families are just non-essential. That, to me, is brutally sad and shameful. Veterans who fought for all the good that this country stands for should be livid and, yes, cynical, watching the representative government that they defended being reduced to such unprofessional, uncaring, and juvenile action. So can anything be stirred within us, especially within veterans and among those in the veterans' circle, to help lift the cynicism and disappointment that we're feeling, to turn the cynicism back into hope, and to address the veteran community's psychological and emotional wounds that show no scars. Come to the Veterans Day ceremony in Missoula at 11 a.m. on November 11th. We'll be talking about it. This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint.
Dan Gallagher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.